Okay, we need to get back on or back in action here. So our next item is following also in helping us, it really is the first part of the meeting we're having tomorrow with Denise Slash. So we appreciate your coming here as well.
Thanks for having me. My last name is Locke.
Locke.
Thank you. Laugh in German.
I knew I'd probably get it wrong, whatever I did.
Everybody says it wrong, but thanks again for having me. You can put up my slides, that would be great. Like Craig, I'm trained as a sociologist, but I was the founding director of the School of Public Policy at Oregon State University, which brought together a lot of social science disciplines who were really interested on looking at policy issues from the big P to the little P kinds of things. So I started my career at the Pacific Northwest National Lab, as you can imagine, a sociologist sat down in the midst of all of these nuclear scientists and energy scientists working on climate change in the early 90s. The problem then was trying to figure out whether or not the ozone hole was the cause of climate change. That is how long I have been working on climate change issues. But as Craig mentioned, the idea of wicked problems, climate change itself is probably the super wicked problems because it's connected to everything. And listening to the issues that the board is dealing with today, trying to think about, do you integrate it? The scientists laid down a challenge yesterday. They took their gloves off and they said, we're not messing around anymore. This is a catastrophe. It's a crisis waiting to happen. And I don't know if you guys saw some of the reports that came out earlier this month about sea level rise, mm-hmm. about how conservative the issues has been addressed in the climate models. And the idea that by 2050, which is 30 years away now, places like Vietnam will be gone, Miami will be gone, big coastal cities will be underwater. And it won't be in 2050 that they're gone. It's going to be over the next 30 years that they're going to be disappearing. And that's going to happen in the U.S. and it's going to happen around the world. And for many people, as Brenda suggested earlier also, is that climate change is really a social justice issue because the people who are going to get hurt are the people who are going to be least able to respond. We're going to be pretty lucky in the Pacific Northwest, I think, with the climate impacts. It'll be interesting to see how we adapt. I was asked to talk today about science and values and natural resource decision, and that's going to fit really well with what Craig talked about. One of the things that I've been working on over the last 25 or 30 years is trying to think about how do you resolve issues or how do you find solutions when you're working on wicked problems. I wanted to start out with this idea of value. There's two basic and very different definitions of value. And one of them is what we think something is worth. What's the value? And we think of it as kind of an exchange for something. It might be worth money. It might be worth our time. It might be worth, are we willing to risk our reputation on it? But there is this sense that there is some worth in something. The other definition is what our principles are, what our values are, what our ideals are. And these things are different, but they're really connected. The interesting thing for me, if you guys are word nerds at all, the etymology of these words is totally different. The value as worth comes from Latin for valoir, which is valor, is the other way we think about that. And value as a principle comes from the German. So they come from two different sources, but in English, we use the same word to talk about the same thing. And sometimes what happens when we're talking about values, we get confused between, are we talking about the value of something as a worth or is a value as our principles? I'm going to be focused mostly on value as the principle and how do we think about bringing values into decision-making. Our biggest real fear, at least scientists' biggest fear, is bringing values into decision-making and into science so that it becomes normative. And this idea of normative science is really a bad word among scientists. And we want to avoid that. And Craig talked a little bit about that, is how do you frame your problems as non-normative? And how do you make sure that they're not preferencing one value over another? With wicked problems, we can think about normative science somewhat differently, in that we need to think about how do you bring in a wide variety of communities who all have different values and different experiences, different needs, different interests, and how do you bring those together so that you can start to achieve, to articulate and achieve some kinds of common interests or common goals, common purposes. And so these are, again, two different ways of thinking about normative science, which I have to tell you right now, when we're working with wicked problems, we're working with normative science. That's what it is. But we can think about it in a slightly different way. So there are some ways of thinking about how you get beliefs into policies. And social scientists think about these different kinds of beliefs, from deep core up through policy to secondary beliefs. The deep core beliefs, this is research that's been done longitudinally around the world for national character. And the axes across the bottom are, what are more important, survival values or self-expression values? So that's the continuum along the x-axis. And on the y-axis is secular versus spiritual kinds of values. So they do these longitudinal studies around the world, and they place countries in these different quadrants. And you can see where the US is there in that sort of self-expression values and sort of a spiritual setting. And that would be sort of the American character. And who our partners are, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, that kind of makes sense, that those are people that we feel some affinity with. And of course, that would be a national deep core belief. And we probably, all of that have us in there somewhere, that there is some sense of that we're about self-expression and that we're also about some kind of non-material value that we share. It's not religion, but it's some kind of non-material value that we all value, that we find important. And there I used value in the sense of worth. And I'll try and be careful about that, because you see what happened is I used that word both ways. The other thing is, these things don't change. These are very difficult to change. They're built into us, they're institutionalized, they're socialized, and they're very difficult to change. Policy core beliefs are more about those social justice issues, whose welfare counts, what's more important, the governance or markets, what's the proper roles of different parties, and where the causes are. These things are also pretty stable. These are also pretty difficult to shift. Secondary beliefs, now remember, we're sort of moving up those belief structures. These are the ones that get really focused on a specific issue. They're about rules, they're about decisions that are getting made. And here's where you get the most flexibility in beliefs, is that these are often more open to negotiation. So when you're thinking about working with a big group of people, you don't want to go at either the core beliefs or the policy beliefs. Those are the ones that are going to get you in the ongoing battles. Whereas if you can focus on some of these secondary beliefs, you can start to think about moving northeast, as Craig put it. So that's one way to think about beliefs. Again, I want to reiterate what Craig was talking about with complex systems. And for me, the thing that makes these things so wicked is that they're dynamic. And what that means is they change, and they never stop changing. Even us just having this conversation today changes what's going on with the Board of Forestry, because you're not going to be the same board tomorrow as you are today, because we're having these conversations, you're listening to what people are saying, and so it just keeps moving. It keeps moving, and the task of the leaders is to keep up with that movement. So the other thing is that there's uncertainty that just comes at every single point, at every single level. And so what happens is this sense of normality has really changed. And while Craig said that wicked problems are the new normal, that may be true, but we have to redefine what normal means then, I think, because we have to think about what does it mean to have highly uncertain and high stakes kinds of problems that we deal with. So when we think about sciences for wicked problems, we can think about it on two different axes. One is the system's uncertainty, how uncertain are the issues that we're dealing with, and how important are the stakes. So if you look down in the, what would be that, the southwest corner, we're looking at normal science. We're looking at applied science where we can put a boundary around what we're interested in. And the decision stakes of any single research project are pretty minimal, aren't they, Brenda? I mean, we find ourselves as scientists putting little bricks in a very large wall, and most of it doesn't mean anything. As we move out, we move into a different kind of science that Craig mentioned, which is some of those assessments. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is actually professional consultancy. It is not normal science. It's people coming together, scientists coming together along with policymakers to come up with a consensus on what we know and what we don't know. And so as we move into these more uncertain systems, we're moving more and more into that kind of meta-analysis or trying to figure out, get a consensus among experts. And the experts don't have to be scientists. They can be policymakers. They can be managers. They can be community members. We're trying to get a more of a consensus on what we know. That does not mean that we leave the normal science behind. We bring that with as we move into the professional consultancy. As we go out even further, and this is where I'm going to say a lot of the, I mean, this is where wicked problems reside, is way out there in what we call post-normal science. And that means we rely on applied science, rely on professional consultancy, but we moved into something completely different. And what the primary difference is with post-normal science is that we bring in a very extended peer community. All of a sudden, we have to rethink who the experts are. They're the people who live on the land. One of the things that I tell my climate modeling folks is that people who have century farms in Oregon, they collect data about temperature, precipitation, first freeze day, last freeze day. They collect exactly the same kind of information that climate scientists put in their model. But they do it on a very specific level. They are experts on climate change on their land because they have at least a 100-year record, which is more than some climate modelers have. I shouldn't say that out loud. But they have 100 years of record of how the weather has changed and varied on their property. They are experts. They are knowledgeable. And those are the kinds of people that have that kind of experience and knowledge that need to be brought into addressing these high stakes, high uncertainty problems. And then I also have this here be dragons. Remember on the old time maps? We're not sure what's out there. We're not sure what's there, but it's probably pretty scary at this point. So we want to think about what the characteristics of post-normal science. And one of them is, as Craig said, is we usually need a decision before the science gets done. The science is always lagging behind. And sometimes the problem itself shoots up the research questions. And then sometimes it changes the research questions in the midst of the research project because the decision framework is moving much faster than science can. There also needs to be a real difference in the level of transparency that you have about what you're doing, why you're doing, why you're changing your mind, why you're using things, why this is credible, why it's not. We also have to really start to manage those uncertainties. And there are lots of tricks for doing that. And Craig talked about some of them. I think one of the things, and this is sort of this idea of what a better solution is, the goal is of this kind of post-normal science is usable knowledge. Knowledge that we can use to make a choice for moving forward. And it's unlikely to be a best, an elegant, or a single solution. I'm working with the city of Spokane now to help them do a vulnerability assessment to climate change. And I was working with some county people and they said, well, are you going to give us a number? A number for what? Well, I can tell you, we can give you a range for how much the climate is. I mean, the temperature is likely to go up, but what difference does that make to Spokane? I mean, you have to integrate that scientific information with what difference does it make or what impact does it have in the local community? But most of us are looking for those elegant solutions. We're looking for a number. We're looking for an answer. The problem is with wicked problems and in post-normal science, there's nothing like that. And again, we're looking at that extended peer community. So I want to talk about three different approaches that I've been experimenting with, that we've been trying out, that we've been working with, and ODF has been one of the subjects of some of this work. So we're trying to think about these three different approaches, and I'll talk about them each briefly. The first is this idea of totally different kinds of science away from disciplinary science, which would be that intradisciplinary science that many of us are trained in, moving toward multidisciplinary, where we bring lots of people together, the economists come in the room with the biologists, and we have a fireworks, whatever. Then we had this cross-disciplinary, we moved into interdisciplinary, and now we're talking about transdisciplinary. The National Science Foundation is looking for us to do transdisciplinary research. I have no idea what transdisciplinary research is, because trans means cross-disciplinary, right? And so that's what they're asking us to do, is for us to work across disciplines and have problems that are identified across disciplines. And that's one way to start thinking about these wicked problems, is how do what I know as a sociologist or as a policy person affect what a computer scientist knows about data manipulation, or what a biologist knows about invasive species? I mean, so how do we bring those things together? It's also kind of adisciplinary, which is where it makes me a little nervous, because I'm trained as an intradisciplinary scientist. I like there to be some kind of boundaries around things. So here's this idea of transdisciplinary, that it sort of is transcending disciplinary boundaries. It's getting rid of them. It's sort of bringing in interdisciplinary with that extended peer group. Remember, we were talking about post-normal science. We want to bring in policymakers to science. You know, how would you even use the information that a climate scientist generates? Well, you can't, for the most part, because it doesn't fit into your decision routines. It doesn't fit into the requirements from the legislature. So bringing those experts into the production of new climate science is really critical for the science to ever be usable. So that's an example of transdisciplinary. It's also trying to find solutions, multiple solutions to wicked problems, and it's trying to take all of this knowledge that we're generating through science and expertise and experience just to some kind of coherent whole and knowledge and approach about the world. It is a huge barrel of stuff to carry in some kind of planning of research or solution solving. Another approach is something that I'm working with folks in Europe and North and Latin America around, something that we call clumsy solutions. And this is sort of accepting that people perceive the world in very different ways. And what looks like a solution to me looks like a problem to you. And so how do we address that? And so how do we bring those things together and create a solution that looks like, you know, this win-win-win-win-win, or whatever we call it. Clumsy solutions, people don't like that name. I kind of like it because it feels a little humble. Most planners, most policy people want elegant solutions where they can put the answer on the table, they can give people marching orders, they can go out and the problem is solved. As you all know, that's not how it works with wicked problems and sort of this post-normal world that we operate in. So we have to think about how do we get all of these different messinesses in there. You're hearing a lot of common words between what Craig and I do. We work a lot with messes, trying to find solutions for messes instead of problems. So this sort of cultural stuff is based on work by anthropologists who, again, are thinking about what are the different approaches that people have to the world. And on the horizontal axis, it's really about how important do you think the individual is compared to the group? So where do you fall on that continuum? Where are decisions best made? Are they best made by individuals, or are they best made socially? And on the vertical axis is how much external imposition or rules or procedures are there on the choices that you make? So those are the two axes. So we put those together and we get these different ways of seeing the world. And let's start in the northeast corner, because that's one of Craig's favorite places to start. And these are people who think that there are rules. There are rules out there. There are choices. There are impositions that are called institutions or whatever. And they also think that the group is a good place for decisions to be made. And so they're hierarchists. Hierarchists believe that there are rules, that there are hierarchies of decision makers, that there are procedures that we can follow. Personally, I'm a hierarchist. I feel comfortable in an organization where I know the hierarchy, I know what the rules are, I know what the procedures are, I know where I can fight my battles. If I go diagonally, across from me are people who are individualists, who believe that all decisions should be made at the individual level, and there should be no external imposition on that. And in fact, there isn't. I don't believe in any institutional controls on my choices. We also call individualist libertarians, that they're really all about the market, they're about individual choice, and they're all about stay out of my hair to government. Across from the individualists are egalitarians. These are the people who are really all about consensus. They're really about thinking about what's good for the group. They're also not really interested in any kind of traditional or historic institutional or social control. They're all about creating something new every time. I think of these people as sort of kumbaya consensus seekers. They talk and talk and talk. Diagonally across from them are people who say there's a lot of institutional external imposition on my choices, and I'm all out there in the world by myself, and there is nothing I can do that makes a difference. Now, some interesting things about this is that people have more affinity with the people who have belief systems or structures that are diagonal to them. As a hierarchist, I'm much more comfortable with working with individualists than I am with working with egalitarians, because egalitarians just frustrate the heck out of me because they just do not want to make a decision. Whereas egalitarians don't want to work with me, and they don't want to work with the they're individualists, because we're just all about like finding a solution and moving forward and setting up a structure and putting somebody in charge. The other thing is that we find is that the fatalists usually drop out of discussions. They throw up their hands and they say, there's nothing we can do about it. If we're lucky, they leave. If we're unlucky, they stay and they keep throwing up their hands and saying, there's nothing we can do about it. The other interesting thing that we found about this is that people, tend to find themselves occupations and workplaces that reflect these very similar values. So if you're in a workplace, or if you're working for an organization or a nonprofit or an academic setting that doesn't share these kinds of worldviews, you're usually an outlier. You're usually a misfit, and you're usually not very comfortable. So I'm an academic, and boy, there is a lot of hierarchy in an academic academia, and I feel comfortable there. There's rules. I think that's probably true in an agency. There's lots of hierarchy. There's lots of rules. People who don't like that don't stick around. First, they make a lot of fire and whatever, but then they leave. So it's kind of interesting. The issue there, of course, is that we're usually around people who see the world in the same way that we do, and that's so we sort of get caught into these ideas that, of course, everybody's a hierarchist, because I am, and everybody knows that's the right way to think. So the other thing is that some environmental scientists have also said that these attitudes are also connected to the way we think about nature. So hierarchists really see that nature is kind of tolerant. If we can manage it, and we can manage it, we can keep that little ball, which we think of as the environment, of going over one of those mountaintops and toppling off the edge. And our job as hierarchists is to manage keeping that environment in that safe place. And so we create a lot of regulations and policies and ways to do that. Cross-diagonally, the individualists see nature as really benign, and it doesn't really matter what we do to it. It will always respond. And in some level, that's really true. Nature will always do what it does. As a hierarchist, I believe that we do have an impact on it. As a individualist, they don't see it quite that way, is that we can do whatever we want. We can knock it around and it will repair itself. The communitarians, egalitarians, on the other hand, see nature as very delicate. And if we're not really, really, really careful, it will get knocked off and fail. And so you can start to think, and then nature capricious, the fatalist said, it doesn't matter what we do, nature's going to do what it wants to do, and I don't have any control over it. So you can think about having people in a room trying to make decisions who bring in these very different ways of seeing who they are in the world and how the environment reacts to human responses. So we've tried to take these ideas of these different approaches into different policy situations. And one of the places we were was down in San Juan Capistrano many years ago, before climate had had any kind of real effect on water. There was already water shortages down there. So we were trying to think about how can we take this clumsy solution idea and bring it into play in a place like San Juan Capistrano, which was under a lot of water stress. It's even more, but there's a silver lining to this one. So they created a conservation rate structure at the time, which was pretty unique, but it's pretty common now. Everyone in San Juan Capistrano got a base rate for a very minimal amount of money for water. This is a rich Orange County, California community. So that base rate included enough water for one swimming pool. Okay, so that was their base rate. Okay, after that, any more water that you wanted for a bigger garden, for a second pool, for a waterfall or whatever, the rate increased. Okay, so you can see, first of all, there was this response to the communitarians is everybody should get the base of what they need. For the libertarians, it was really interesting in that if you want more and you can afford it, you can pay for it and you can have it. So there was all that sort of built in that. Now, for the hierarchists, what was really interesting is they put information on the water bills, not just for yourself, but for your neighbors. So you were watching what your neighbors were using for water. And so all of a sudden there's all this pressure and there's all this measurement and there's all this like ranking in the community who's using the most water. I mean, you can think about what hierarchists did, right? They had a field day. Guess what? Water use, water demand use in San Juan Capistrano went in a way that the economists said were impossible. But there was, because everyone sort of had their needs met, the egalitarians, everybody who needed water had water, the libertarians who wanted more water could afford it, who could have it, and the hierarchists could have a field day with data and hierarchies and management. They were all happy, and they're still doing fine down there, even when drought hits California and fire. So we were trying to, again, I already went through that, but we were trying to think about how do you get these clumsy solutions. A lot of communities now use rate structures, different differential rate structures, so that's become quite common over the last 20 years. But some of this other stuff is not quite as common yet. So we think about what are some clumsy solutions for climate change, which is the super wicked problem. So we think about, for the individualists, we're thinking about technical solutions that address problems everywhere. So you're thinking about geoengineering kinds of solutions where they're talking about seeding the clouds or putting up big sky umbrellas or whatever they're thinking about. Is there some way to create that kind of structure that will allow me to keep doing whatever I do, but we're going to manage the greenhouse gas emissions some way? For the egalitarians, there's this whole idea of adaptation and this idea that we're going to change production, consumption, and there's all that kind of talk about adaptation that's happening at the very community level. And all of that is going on right now. And on the hierarchists, you have all this sort of carbon emission control. I mean, even just talking about what's going on in here, you can see all of those different kinds of approaches trying to have some way of coming together for a solution for a wicked problem that looks like climate change. Thinking about how do you address the desires or the needs or the expectations of people with very different worldviews, very different perspectives. And there probably are some ways to move forward on this. So the third way that we're working on is this whole idea of co-production of knowledge. And this is where we're out there on that post-normal scientist, where we're trying to get groups of people together to try and create data that they can turn into information, that they can turn into knowledge that they can use. And that's why I'm defining knowledge. It's information that you can use. It's not just data that's generated by a model or by a scientist. So we have community members who want to participate, start at the very beginning. They help frame the problems. They identify the acceptable methods, what the sources of evidence. They help interpret the data within local context, and then they develop workable solutions for that local community. And then the people who are participating disseminate the information to the broader community. So there is this really sort of circular process where we're iterating back and forth. We've done this with several communities in Oregon and Washington. We're working right now with Spokane and also with the North Mid-Coast Watershed Basin to try and think about how do you develop adaptation to climate change. So this is one Knowledge to Action Network in Idaho, which was in the Bigwood Basin. At the top of the basin is Sun Valley. And it's very high-end resort. People have not just second homes there, but they have their third homes and their helicopters and their jets there. And at the bottom of the valley is low-value agriculture, mostly grazing, some crop raising. But there's this huge gradient of land use and economic sort of kinds of structures in place. The problem there is, like the rest of the West, the climate change is really affecting snowpack. And snowpack, if you're at Sun Valley, that's really, really critical. So they have invested a lot of money in snowmaking machines. And so they're pumping snow up into those mountains because people are paying hundreds of dollars to ski at Sun Valley. The farmers were watching that going on and saying, you know what, that's our water. I mean, what are you doing to it? And so there got to be this big tension in this area where you had these very rich people flying in, utilizing resources, and people were trying to make a living there. So we brought them together and tried to think about how do you create a solution or help them think about gathering information that they could use as knowledge. So we started by forming a research agenda around the needs of the stakeholders. And you guys have been in these meetings, but believe it or not, that model in the lower right-hand corner, that is a wicked problem, and that is how the community defined what was going on in the Bigwood Basin. We did not set that up. This is what it looks like when we cleaned it up a little bit, but you can see even just the issues that they identify are not at any kind of equitable scale. Not only that, many of them cannot be answered with a research question or a research issue. So we helped them develop research questions that we could do some research on, drivers of change, how they would affect the quantity and the quality of water, where water scarcity is most likely to occur, and what policies would be most effective in managing this. But we tried two things. We brought people together to address the key questions, including stakeholders and water managers and state agencies and some federal folks together. And we ask these kinds of questions. Are the right people in the room? How do we get the kind of data that we need? Because remember, we're not generating our own data. We're going to use what's out there. And then we created a webinar series for people to get up to date on some of the things that they needed to know, including climate modeling, which when you're working on climate change, this is always a big stumbling block. So the first thing we did is we helped people in the community understand what the different climate models said about climate change in Idaho. And as a group, they identified three of the models as best representing what might go on in the Big Wood. So that was a decision they made together, and we rolled out everything from that decision. Those are the ones that are circled. One of them predicted a hot, dry future. Another predicted a warm, wet future. And another model predicted low change. So these were these climate models that we spent billions of dollars on. This was just for this area in Idaho. Those are the ones they selected. So the next thing we did is we took some decision support tools, and we started out with two methods. We did a systems dynamics model, and then we did a spatially explicit modeling process. The first thing is they modeled the system dynamics in their water basin above and below their reservoir. And the community did this. These were not scientists or engineers that did this. They had help from scientists and engineers, including the USGS and the Bureau of Reclamation. And they were able to draw this up. And when they got done, they said, it doesn't give us the information we need to make the decisions that we want, because it only focuses on water flow in the basin. And there were all these other things going on that they recognized as part of their wicked problem. So then we shifted over to this spatially explicit modeling platform that integrated the natural system, the human system, and the regional downscale climate model into a big model that was basically looking to see what was going on in the basin. Well, we also said we need to think about what are some alternative scenarios. And this is a community said, let's look at the economic base. Is it going to be agriculture? Is it going to be tourism? And is it going to be highly managed or is it going to be less managed? So we had these four different approaches that went into the model to see how each of these approaches affected the outcome. And then we ran them by those three climate models. So all of a sudden we have 12 scenarios. And it's sort of like, okay, we have 12 scenarios. And guess what? We had information. We had data. We had information coming out of our ears. No one, literally, no one knew what to do with it. So the next step, we said, what's most important to us? What, as a community, what were the storylines? So we stepped back from all of the high tech and the sciencey kind of language and said, what are the stories that are most important to this area? And it was temperature, snowpack, and water demand. That was it. And so we went and we created these storylines that had a take-home message about what's going to happen with, what's this one? Snowpack. What's going to happen with snowpack over the next 100 years in the Bigwood Basin? Key features, key points, what data, lots of sources. And these were all created by the community members, for the community members, who then went on to talk to the wider community about what they found about the impact of climate on the Bigwood Basin. So I think some of the lessons that we've learned through this idea of transdisciplinary, clumsy solutions, co-production of knowledge, is it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time. And people drop in, they drop out, they drop in, they drop out. But it takes a lot of time, and it takes, you just have to be knowing that that's what's going to happen. We also found that bringing in local expertise, local sources of data, really increased the legitimacy of the findings. And by increasing the legitimacy of the findings, we reduce the arguments about what, when, if, who's to blame. All of that sort of just gets hashed out in the co-production of the knowledge that they need to use. We also have a whole lot to learn about how do you communicate really complicated information and how do you do that. So other projects that I have working on are how do you visualize data so that people can see it on the landscape. I mean, this is where it really gets down when you're looking at these complicated problems, especially like in the forest where topography, for example, is a real issue. How do you display that on a two-dimensional graph so that people understand that there's differences in different places? So I think about, when we think about decision-making for wicked problems and we're thinking about how we work on this together, is that we need to think about how do you extend the peer community to the people who want to be involved. When we think about the public, when social scientists think about the public, we think about the involved public. These are the people who show up at your meetings. They're the people who write the letters. And you really want to pay attention to those people. The next group are the attentive public. They're paying attention, but they're not necessarily showing up until they get mad or something really happens. And they're informed. So then you have a larger group of people out there. And then you have the people who aren't informed, aren't involved, and don't care. And so you can maybe set those aside and think of those as the fatalists and concentrate in how do you make sure that the involved and the attentive public are getting the kind of knowledge or data or information they need to understand what it is going on in the agency. There's lots of way to involve the public. ODF has done many of these different things, tried them out at different times. I was reminded you were talking about climate refugees or species. I mean, Ross McDonald and Gail Achterman and I did a project for ODF many years ago to try and think about how do you create salmon refuges on the state forests. And we tried this clumsy solution model. It didn't work. And that's the thing that I want to tell you. There's no guarantee that it's going to work, because the problem was wicked and it changed. It changed even as we were working on this 1 year project that turned into a 2 year project where all the issues changed from day one to day 366. And we were basically holding a bunch of time and resources up in the air. I think the other thing is that this real awareness that there's different ways of seeing the world. We know that. I mean, we know that intuitively, but is there some way to say, oh, he's thinking like a hierarchist. She's thinking like a libertarian. And so what is it that you're hearing from them? And what you're hearing are their values. And they can frame it anyway, as Craig was suggesting, is that when you hear people, hear their values and the way they frame things and how you do that. And this is one way to do that. It's, whoa, like that. I think the other thing is this whole idea of collaborative governance is that we're really moving towards that at every level. I have PhD students who are looking at collaborative governance at the federal level, which is a real ball of nastiness, but we'll figure it out. And the other thing I want to say is these collaborative solutions, these clumsy solutions, these things where you're doing this extended peer community, they really seem to have moral force and political influence in a way that a decision made by an agency or by an individual don't. And so while they may only be local forces, they may be solutions that can hold you in place for a while. Clumsy or wicked questions?
Want to help get us back on schedule too, but anybody have a burning question at this point? I mean, this is all really helpful foundational stuff for us, and we were probably all thinking about how it affects something we're involved in.
I don't really have a question. I just think it was a great presentation. Thank you. I really appreciate the whole concept about multiple legitimate perspectives, and you really emphasize the value of people with local knowledge and all of that, mm-hmm. as well as the scientists. And I think it's very easy for us to forget that. So thank you.
Well, I don't think the public lets you forget it, do they? Not for long.
Right. That's our experience most every day we meet.
Yeah.
Certainly. Well, I have found myself, after 20 years of owning a ranch, that I have been there now a few times recently in front of some sort of scientific presentation, and I'm that old guy saying, but that's not what I'm saying here on the ground. So.
And I do think that local knowledge is really critical, because science is abstract. I mean, it tries to abstract, and it moves away from what's happening on the ground. And so we lose all of that knowledge about what landowners or employees or people who work on the land know about it. The trick is, how do you get all that information into the decision process? And so what are the practices and systems that you put in place to do that?
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.